Good morning. I confess that I've had a bit of trepidation about this. I want to thank David Feldman and the other organizers, but like many of you, I have wondered whether it is possible to have a meaningful and constructive dialogue in a group that has essentially two different kinds of people with entirely different ways of seeing the world. Lawyers and non-lawyers. And I think it remains to be seen whether this can be done or not, but I'm willing to be game and to at least give it a try. So as you've heard, my topic is anti-Israel boycotts and American anti-discrimination law, an area in which I've been involved in various capacities over the years. And I'm going to ask one very specific question about that. I'm not going to give a survey of all of the different sorts of questions and issues, and there are lots of interesting and some easy, some difficult questions, and I'm going to avoid trying to give a survey and instead to focus on one question that I find to be both interesting and hard, which is whether there are circumstances in which hostility towards Zionism or Zionists may constitute a violation of civil rights law. And I'm going to concentrate on that because it is continually arising in the discourse surrounding anti-Semitism, certainly on American college campuses, and because it may arise also in some of the pending legal cases. Civil rights advocates frequently argue that the movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel sometimes creates a hostile environment for Jewish Americans, particularly on university campuses, and therefore violates applicable American civil rights statutes, such as Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VI, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in federally funded educational programs, including colleges and universities. Now, this is not the only legal issue that arises with respect to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. There have been questions that have been raised under a whole host of other laws, ranging from the Export Administration Act to the Ribicoff Amendment to the tax code to state and local law. But the significance of this civil rights statute is that it is currently raised in a number of pending administrative cases. So it is the one area that is active and a live issue, certainly for the administrative agency which oversees the question of non-discrimination on American college campuses, which is the Office for Civil Rights, I'll call it OCR, at the Department of Education. Now, when I ask about whether hostility towards Zionism or Zionists can create a hostile environment for Jews in violation of the law, I'm asking what I take to be a hard question. And when I ask what I think are hard questions, I always try to point out that in many cases the most interesting and important and even understudied questions in this area are actually the easy questions, right? Because there are certainly many cases where there are allegations that Jews, as Jews, are assaulted or their property vandalized or they're threatened, not for being a Zionist, but for being Jews, and that the context suggests that it's their Jewishness and not necessarily any sort of political context. When a person says that Hitler should have finished the job or Jews should be finished off in the ovens or go back to Russia or die Jews or fucking Jews or all the different sorts of things that have reportedly been said on different some college campuses. These I take to be somewhat easier questions because they relate much more closely to the complainant being a Jew. But there is often a response that in a particular incident, we're not talking about Jews. Not Jews, not Israel, right? We're not talking about Jews, we're not talking about Israel. And sometimes what they say, they won't say we're talking about a system of oppression, they'll say more specifically we're talking about Zionists or Zionism, and that's often the defense, right? And the defense might be factually based, or it might not be factually based. But the question that I would want to raise is, suppose it's true. Suppose it could be demonstrated, or at least not disproved, that in a particular instance, hostility aimed at a particular person is not because she's Jewish, but because she's Zionist. So for instance, on a particular college campus on a particular afternoon, a woman stands on a quad holding up, a Jewish woman holding up a sign that says, "Israel wants peace." Okay? At which point she is attacked from behind by a person pushing a shopping cart full of goods, sending her essentially to the hospital. Right? And in the surrounding incidents, we know that the perpetrator has also been making comments and statements about Zionists and Zionism, and there are in the area sort of stereotypical assertions about Zionists that are in the atmosphere. I'm not going to ask what is the standard for determining a violation, the severe or pervasive. I'm not going to ask what sort of evidence is required, nor what the remedy is, or what is anti-Semitism. But rather the question is, suppose it is true, or cannot be disproven, that this woman was targeted not because she's a Jew, but because she is a Zionist. Is that enough to say, maybe there's been a criminal misdemeanor incident, but there has not been anything that could be part of a hostile environment towards Jews, which would trigger a requirement on the part of the university to take prompt and effective action to make sure that other persons in this group feel welcome on the campus. So it's about whether that is triggered on an incident where, for purposes of discussion, the perpetrator is chosen not just because she's Jewish, but as a Zionist. And what I would argue is that the answer, in at least some of these incidents, should be yes. That there are cases in which, even if the person is targeted not because she's a Jew, but because she's a Zionist, that shouldn't be enough as a defense, because there are attacks on Zionism that could be characterized as discrimination on the basis of a trait which is stereotypically associated with a protected characteristic. Being Jewish is considered a protected characteristic in terms of ethnic or ancestral discrimination. Okay. Now, let me say by way of just a little bit of context that when Title VI prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin, there has been debate about whether Jews get any protection whatsoever, because the word religion is not mentioned. And one could write a book on it, which sadly I have, on the question of, if you prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin, does that have anything to do with Jews at all when Jews are a religion, right? But long story short, the current policy of the OCR is that discrimination or harassment against Jews may violate Title VI if it is based on ethnic or ancestral characteristics. So to reframe the question now, what we're asking under current interpretations of Title VI is whether some forms of hostility to Zionism may be considered to be ethnic or ancestral discrimination against Jews. Yeah. What I would argue is the best way to think about this is to think of it in terms of the question about traits that are associated with a particular group, a particular disadvantaged group, in terms of cultural or historical stereotypes. Because this is not just about Jews. And I'll try to give a couple of examples, but let me start with one or two about women. So a question arose about what does it mean to engage in sex discrimination? Of course, we looked at this over and over again in different sorts of contexts. But it arose once with respect to an accountant, Ms. Hopkins, who had a job with a big firm. And she was frustrated in her career advancement. And she said it was sex discrimination. And her employer said, no, we hire and promote lots of women, just as we hire and promote lots of men. And she says, well, it may be that you hire and promote lots of women, but you have a certain expectation of women that you don't have about men, which is that they behave in a certain manner. They conform to gender stereotypes. And they're not saying you can't be a woman and be here, But they're saying that I'm not sufficiently feminine, right? They're saying that as a woman, I should comport myself in a particular way. And what the U.S. Supreme Court said is that when Congress prohibits sex discrimination, one of the things that it's doing implicitly is prohibiting discrimination against people who fail to conform to a cultural stereotype about what it means to be a woman. And this has been expanded, both within the courts and by OCR, to mean that you can't be discriminated against either because you fail to conform to a stereotype, a gender stereotype, or because you actually do exhibit the stereotype. That is to say, if you're too feminine and you don't get career advancement, that doesn't work either. And this is now part of the law, and it's a very important part of the law right now because there are all sorts of questions about what does this ultimately mean, right? Because there are lots of times where people will face different sorts of harassment in ways it's hard to tell. Is it because they're gay? Is it because they don't conform to masculine stereotypes? And sexual orientation discrimination may not be prohibited, but the courts and agencies will often say, well, when you are treated in certain ways and called certain names, it may not just be because the person is gay, but because they fail to conform to it. At any rate, what I would argue is that while not every Jew is a Zionist, and many Jews are anti-Zionists, yeah, a commitment to Israel and the things that go with it is certainly culturally identified with Jews. Certainly it's disproportionately connected with Jews. And the way in which Zionism is discussed, and certainly the way in which Zionism is stigmatized in certain contexts, often has a lot to do with traditional stereotypes about Jews. So for instance, when Zionists and Zionism are portrayed as being greedy and conspiratorial and engaged in international criminal activities, and where Zionists are portrayed as very large-nosed individuals in cartoons, there are lots of different ways in which sometimes, I don't mean always, but in some instances, in which the assault on Zionism is connected very closely to stereotypes of Jews. I want to make clear, I'm not talking about the BDS movement as a whole. I'm not talking about the whole rhizomic, pleasurable, transgressive, non-ideological multitude, as it were, which sounds wonderful to me, like a great party. But I'm talking about particular incidents which very frequently take place in the wake of BDS activity on different sorts of campuses. Another example that I'll give, if this hasn't been provocative enough, is that in some ways I would argue the most hardcore depictions of Zionism are in some ways broadly analogous to the most hardcore offensive portrayals of women, which is to say, Jews are often involved in the production of anti-Zionism. Women are often involved in the production of pornography. You will get a wide range of opinions among the Jewish community about Zionism and among women about pornography. Most forms in the United States, most forms of pornography are protected freedom of speech, and the same, I would argue, is true of most forms of anti-Zionism. In most cases, both can circulate freely, and there are certainly instances in environments that are regulated by the anti-discrimination laws, like the workplace or the college campus, in which the hardcore usage of pornography can reinforce stereotypes of women that are harmful, and for that reason, there are cases in which the use of hardcore pornography is considered to be part of a hostile environment to women. And I would argue the same can be the case with respect to anti-Zionism that reinforces dangerous stereotypes about Jews. Now, I'm going to having raised the accountant's case, Pricewaterhouse. I forget if I named it. It's Pricewaterhouse versus Hopkins. Let me mention a distinction which is important, which is that ethnic and racial minorities have not always fared as well in these sorts of issues as women in American law. They've not always been covered under the same standards, and yet it is a huge issue. It is a huge issue in the sense that nowadays, with respect to any number of different racial or ethnic groups, the sorts of discrimination which is found, whether in the workplace, on the campus, or elsewhere, is not very clearly and explicitly directed to the fact that someone is black or Hispanic or Asian or what have you, but is rather directed to a trait which is culturally associated with a particular group, right? So the question comes up when the employer does not want an employee to do data entry if the employee has a Hispanic accent. And they say, well, it's not that we're discriminating against Hispanics, but we just want people to be able to speak in a particular way, even though that does not appear to be a bona fide occupational qualification of data entry. Right? So the accent may be culturally associated with some groups and disproportionately correlated with, in a particular workforce, the Hispanics who've been terminated or not hired. And it comes up with respect to certain groups that have different hairstyles or grooming or clothing that are culturally associated. And the question is, under what circumstances is it okay to say we will discriminate against this group? And this is a tough issue for the law, and it's one which is evolving. Okay. So sometimes it is said that if a characteristic or trait is mutable, if it's mutable, if there's a changeable relationship to the protected characteristic, it's not protected. Okay. Two quick things about that. One is the meaning of immutability is not immutable, which is to say it's been quarter century since the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the issue. And when it did, it said that an immutable characteristic is one that you're born with. Right? So one isn't necessarily born a Zionist. But it's not clear whether immutability remains a viable aspect of American law at this point. And there has been a trend within some courts, and certainly in the scholarship, to say that if immutability is a requirement, that we should understand it not as meaning something from birth, since that has implications about essentialist and perhaps biological notions of race or ethnicity, which really don't make sense nowadays. But rather, it's a question about whether there are certain characteristics that are so closely integrated with one's personal identity that it would be inappropriate to ask someone to change that. Right? And so, for instance, Judge Michael McConnell, former judge and now professor Michael McConnell, has argued that asking a Jew to give up the Jewish religion, saying that it's mutable, doesn't make a lot of sense because to a religious Jew, the Jewish religion is not something that you can just easily give up. Now, if Judge McConnell is correct in suggesting that a 3,000-year history of a connection to a religion is not something that should be considered mutable, then it seems to me that all of the same arguments apply to a commitment of the same duration and an analogous nature to Israel. So in closing, I want to say that in my remarks, I've said nothing about anything you could call legitimate criticism of Israel, nor of political discussions per se, but rather I've tried to establish that there are at least some circumstances in which it is not sufficient to respond to the anti-Semitism charge by saying it's not anti-Semitism, it's anti-Zionism, because there are cases in which a hostile environment towards Zionism should be construed as a hostile environment for Jews. Thank you.